Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. My guest today turned her skills as an award-winning journalist into becoming a best-selling novelist. Kate Holohan joins me with her Three Lives, a new psychological thriller with a high-tech spin. It explores what happens to a social media influencer's world when her seemingly perfect life and marriage is turned upside down following a savage home invasion. Let me tell you a little about Kate, and we'll bring her right on. Kate's an award-winning journalist. She wrote for publications such as The Record, Business Week, and The Boston Globe. She's now the USA Today bestselling author of four domestic suspense novels, including The Widower's Wife. Today we're talking about her latest, as I said. It's called Her Three Lives, and here is my guest, Kate Holohan. Kate Holohan, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. So excited to be on.
Well, it's very exciting to have another new book out, I'm sure. Before we dive into that, we haven't talked before, so I'd like to just have a little chat about your background to let our listeners know more. I read in a former life you were an award-winning journalist. You were also the lead singer of Leaving Kinsley, a rock band in New York City. So which came first, or did they kind of bloom together?
I ran concurrently. I was a journalist. Really, since I was 14, I started off writing obituaries at the local newspaper, and then from there, kind of graduated to writing local news, and then after that, being a columnist, and then I went on to Business Week, writing stories for the online publication and the magazine, and so that was my journalism, and then kind of in my spare time, I wrote fiction, and I also, wrote songs with my band when we performed throughout New York, and, you know, it was a lot of fun. Nothing ever came of it, but we had a good time.
But that's half the battle, right? The fun bit is what it's all about, really, in those kind of situations.
Getting that creative energy out. Yeah.
Yes, yes. I love also that you have a food-obsessed dog, because so do I. And I love that you admit on your website that you spend a disturbing amount of time highly caffeinated, mining your own anxieties for material. And that made me laugh, Kate, because, you know, there's very few people who will admit to that, but I know for sure from writer friends that definitely happens.
Yes, I think, how else do you come up with thriller ideas other than to find things that really unnerve you and keep you up at night and just go, finally, it's like you break and go, I have to learn everything I can about that, if only to quiet my own brain.
Right, right. So at what point did you decide to tackle your first book? I think this is your fifth, is that correct?
That's right. This is my fifth book. So my first book, at the time I was working at CNBC, I was a business news producer, and I had my second child and just thought, you know, the daily news schedule was really difficult with one child. It was going to be pretty impossible with two. Mm. So I said, I'm going to take some time off, and I'm going to really buckle down and try and write this book. And I'd written other books before, but it wasn't necessarily my best work. And so here, without actually writing every day something else, I was really able to kind of concentrate all my writing in this one avenue. And then after that, I got an agent and I sold it, and then it became a career. So I didn't go back to journalism.
And so I've seen you quoted several times as being a domestic suspense novelist. Do you think that's a fair description?
I mean, I do, in that a lot of my stories revolve around the home and intimate relationships between husbands and wives, or parents and children, or siblings. And so, I guess in a literal sense, right, these are thrillers that happen in the home, so they're domestic suspense. And so I think that fits. But I like to think of myself as just, you know, I tell stories about intimate relationships and kind of how they go wrong.
Yeah. You know, people do love to categorize, and they like to put people in buckets, you know, with a label on it. one of the things you talk about in here, or several of the topical themes, gaslighting, May-December relationship, social media, of course, and the paranoia that can spring from having live feed cameras everywhere and phone apps everywhere, which everybody is, you know, everybody's doing this today. It horrifies me. How did the overall concept come to you? Was there something in particular that generated this story idea?
Oh, yes. Well, there were a few things. One, you know, I had a lot of cameras in my own house. And we started when the kids were young, you know, just almost like nursery cams to make sure that they, if they woke up, we'd be there. And then pretty soon, we kind of, the kids got older, and I was using it to adjudicate fights. Like, I would say, well, you know, we have a camera in that room, so I can see what happened. And I kept thinking, that has to be psychologically damaging.
Right. I couldn't imagine, because we used to fight all the time as kids. I mean, everything on, absolutely.
That's what you can say. I'm going to the tape. So I just, you know, so I started to think about that. And then I thought, you know, you kind of put it on yourself and go, well, how would I feel if somebody was always watching me? Right. And then the story springs from there.
Mm-hmm. So it begins, Her Three Lives begins with protagonist Jade Thompson and her fiancé Greg Hamlin getting ready for an event. Would you give our listeners a synopsis of the story? I like the author to do this so I don't give away things I shouldn't give away.
I'm the worst. I'll tell everybody everything, including the ending. And I'm like, oh, wait, no, I'm supposed to be selling the book. it's a story about, as you said, a May-December relationship. Greg Hamlin is a... you know, he was married before, he has adult children, and he gets divorced, and then after his divorce, he meets Jade Thompson, and they fall in love, and they are, they're starting their new life together, and it's interrupted, this second act that Greg has, by a pretty brutal home invasion in which he's hit over the head and suffers a traumatic brain injury. His injury, fortunately for him, or as if I didn't write it, fortunately for him, he has some PTSD, and he's in trying to secure his home and keep himself and his new fiance safe. He installs all these cameras and starts kind of obsessively watching them, and through the watching starts to think that his new fiance had something to do with the home invasion and his attempted murder. And, you know, he's aided in this thinking by his adult children, who have a lot of distrust for this young woman in his life. And so that's kind of where the story comes from. And you have to ask, well, who's really the victim here and who's the aggressor? And it changes throughout. And, that's it.
And so why did you decide to create this May-December relationship, if you will?
Well, I wanted to... you know, you're always looking for sources of tension when you write thrillers, and I wanted to kind of play on stereotypes, where I think that one of the problems when we rely too much on screens and digital technology and we are not actually meeting people face-to-face and getting to know them on a deeper level, or we rely too much on social media, is that we fill in a lot of details based on stereotypes. Right, so you have this character, Jay Thompson, who has to deal with the stereotypes of a younger woman being with an older man, and he has to deal with the same stereotypes, and you know, of an older man, why he would want a younger woman, and some of those, you know, like with all stereotypes, you know, every now and then there might be a grain of truth to one, but there's a lot of stuff that actually has no application.
Right,
and that was kind of what I wanted to delve into. I also wanted to kind of attack some of the stereotypes of people when they get together across cultures. You know, there's I'm half Jamaican and half Irish American, and there's a stereotype of Caribbean women when they marry Caucasian American men that, oh, it's for the green card, or oh, it's about the money, and you know, that becomes a problem. That's something that people have to deal with, and certainly my parents, you know, my mom is Jamaican, had to deal with some of that. And so I wanted to take a look at how damaging those can be, and then how they can be exacerbated by digital technology.
Yeah, it's an important topic, especially now. In fact, you know, I was thinking, I read this in the acknowledgements, that your parents got married just about 10 years or so after interracial marriage was legalized in America. And it wasn't until I saw a film on Netflix just a few weeks ago. It was actually made in 2016. It's called Loving, and it's about Richard Loving and his wife. It wasn't until then that I realized it actually had been banned here. I didn't realize to the extent of that. And it was so difficult to watch, so upsetting on so many levels. So I think, yeah, it's an important subject and it's ongoing.
Yes, I mean, I love that film. In fact, talk about social media. My mother makes sure she posts every year when the anniversary comes up where it became legal on a federal level to remind people, I think, that it wasn't always so, and kind of hint at some of the things that they had to deal with. And it was legal when my parents obviously got together because it was 10 years after. But, you know, it takes a while for some of these stereotypes to go away and for people to be as accepting.
Yeah. Right. And so I also read that your parents taught you never to let someone else define your culture or your heritage, your sense of self, and that is so key. How has that helped shape you as a woman and as a writer over the years?
Right. Well, I think it's given me freedom to tell stories that I feel like I know intimately. And I think that's always difficult particularly when I look kind of ethnically ambiguous because I am half white and half black. And so sometimes there's a feeling of like, well, how could she possibly know? You know, and people are honestly just judging off of a photo. I even had once where my agent was selling a book and somebody said, well, you know, does the main character, maybe they shouldn't be black because it won't be an own voices story. And my agent had to say, you do realize that she's half black, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that was just somebody looking at a photo, and in that particular photo that they saw based on their own reference point, assuming something about my knowledge of a culture.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's something that I think it's important to know who you are and feel comfortable telling the stories that you feel like you've had intimate experiences with. And they've helped me do that.
Yes, and it's a subject of much debate lately about whether somebody like myself, for example, could write about a Chinese culture or about an Indian culture. And I have mixed feelings on that because I think, you know, if you're good at what you do, you should be able to dive into it and pull something from it. But it is a matter of huge debate right now. One that I try and avoid, but it's just, you know, there's a no-win situation there almost.
I agree. I think it's really difficult, and I think the key is how well you do it, right?
Yes.
Because
yeah.
if you do it really well, then nobody says anything because they like the characters and they feel that they're honest.
Yeah.
Right? And the problem becomes when somebody thinks they've done it well and hasn't, and then other people are reading about their experience in a way that they feel is caricaturized.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's difficult. I mean, for example, in this book, Greg is an older white male. Clearly I'm not, right? But if I wrote only characters that were like me, I mean, also where would the conflict be other than clearly someone was being cloned? But beside that, you know, you have to have people with different perspectives in order to kind of create drama sometimes.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so let's look at your characters then. And in general, when you're developing characters, what kind of questions do you ask as you create them? What do you want to know about them?
Yeah. Well, one, I always want to know about their childhood, whether I put it in or not, because I think that how people grew up and also what they wanted when they were a child that they didn't get. Because I think that we spend a lot of our adult lives trying to reconcile things that we felt incapable of changing when we were kids. And that's the psychology that goes into my character. So, for example, there's, you know, one of the characters in this book has an issue with a parent and some things that happened there that would naturally maybe make them gravitate towards a certain kind of person. Right?
Yeah.
And I wanted to have that in place. And so I think that that's all, you know, I want to know all of that about them. I also, you want to know all the the things that just make, that round out a person's life, what they eat, when they go to bed, like what kind of people they're attracted to, what are their insecurities. And then when you have a good sense of them, you try to kind of understand how they would react to certain stressors. And you know, you try to create characters in my world that will react particularly badly to certain stressors, so that way you get kind of a suspenseful thriller. You know, if I always say, if I had a character that was very nice and always completely forthright and honest and didn't have any insecurities, well, probably a murder wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Well, I was going to ask how deeply you dive into their motivation, what actually drives them, the why of their existence, if you will, and at what point they would, say, for example, compromise their integrity. I mean, do you dive that deeply into it, or does this that part evolve as you go along?
Yeah, I think I'm a plotter, so I have a good sense of the things that are going to happen in the story, and sometimes, you know, I often have to change that when the character starts developing in a maybe a way I didn't expect. But I like to go in trying to feel like I have a good sense of what that character's pain points are, the things that are so secret to them that they would lie about it, or at the very least commit lies of omission, and then how those would, you know, lead to distrust. And then, and unfortunately, I think in life in general, like once that seed of distrust is planted, it's very hard for people to get back to good.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And so sometimes you really just need to find, like, what's the pain point that would force a lie? And once you're there, you have a good story.
Do you have a favorite character in Her Three Lives?
Yes. I think my favorite character was Jade's mother. I thought that she, you know, she's very protective of her daughter, but she's... But, you know, she's also, she had some kind of awful things that happened in her life, and then she had to rebuild from that. And I think she's a pretty strong female character, and I just had a lot of fun writing her. There were some parts of my own mother that I put in there that I'm sure my mom will recognize. So,
I was going to ask if your mom recognized those bits.
Yeah, I mean, it's always funny when you do that and you think, oh, is my mom going to sit there and read that and be like, oh, you know, get upset with me? But my mom's a pretty good sport. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, she probably would, if it was my mom, she'd go, you know, when are my royalties coming in? as a joke, right? So if this were made into a movie, and I could see it as a movie, Greg is what, 52, Jade is 32. Who would you see playing in an ideal world, the characters, those two characters?
Oh, well, there's so many. I mean, you know, when I was thinking of Greg, I think I was, Michael Shannon for some reason. I think because Michael Shannon does that intense look very well.
Mm-hmm.
So when I could imagine him like staring at the computer screens and still be riveting, even though he's doing nothing but sitting down and looking at something.
Right. Right.
And then for Jade, you know, Alicia Wainwright, who was recently in a movie Palmer, she's actually American of Jamaican descent, and I think she has like a certain sweetness to her, at least in the role she's played.
Yeah,
I thought was pretty cool.
I can definitely see that. I can definitely see that. Did you? What kind of research did you have to do for this story?
Well, I did a lot of research about digital home technology. Some of that technology I have in my actual house, but you know, I kind of looked at ways that it could be abused, that it could be hacked, how you would spy on someone else, and So I guess I did that, and then I also, you know, I did a lot of research about architecture because Greg is an architect. So what are some of the things that he thinks about? And also, what are some of the personalities that kind of go, that are attracted to architecture as a career? And what kind of personality does it take to make it to the top of that field where Greg is kind of towards the top of that field?
Yeah.
And then I used that once I had him fleshed out that way. So I talked to people who... in some cases were married to architects or had been architects, or especially the ones that had been architects in the 80s and could talk about some of the crazy wild days, which didn't exactly make it into the story, but was in the back of my mind when I was writing it.
Yeah. Okay. And so what did you have a most difficult part of the book to write? So usually there's, you know, on a big piece like this, there's somewhere we struggle.
Yeah. I mean, so it's funny. Usually it's the second act, right? Because you need to lay things out very slowly, but at the same time have it feel like it's moving fast. So I think that, but actually in this book, it might have been the ending because I was torn between wanting all the forces that had created this initial drama not to win, but at the same time understanding that they had done a certain amount of damage that would have to be reckoned with. And so I think that was hard for me because whenever you get attached to your characters and you want them to have a happy life at the end of it,
yeah.
Especially if you spent the book mistreating them. So,
right.
So I think that was a bit of a challenge.
And so when you have challenges like that, what is it that inspires you to push through? Obviously your deadline, but beyond that, I mean, what tools or resources do you turn to keep you motivated and pushing through that?
I often find that most writer's block is due to a lack of research, right? Is that
yeah.
there's something where you honestly just don't know how the character would react or how they would feel, and then you have to go back in and delve, well, what don't I know about this person yet, right? Or what don't I know about my setting that is influencing them? Or there's something where you can often solve it with more information. So once you kind of figure that out, it's like, you know, for example, at one point, one of the characters goes to visit someone in prison. And I found that I got through that scene by just learning a lot about what you have to do to visit someone in prison, right? Like the fact that what they search you, what you're allowed to bring, how they suggest that you dress, all of these things. And then once I thought about the character dealing with those constraints, it really helped me through that scene.
That's interesting. They even tell you, they advise you on how to dress?
Yes, because, they want people to dress pretty... demurely.
Yes.
So as not
sense.
To kind of create any excitement among other prisoners. So they dictate it. And if you are deemed not, you know, being covered up enough, you're sent away.
Interesting. So how did writing this book help you grow as a writer? What did you learn from this that you'll maybe take forward into writing your next book?
Well, I think, you know, every book helps you grow. This one, I think I learned a lot. I honed my pacing, I guess was the best thing. I think this one really, because in some ways, you know, I've written other books where there's a detective character, right? And so that detective's actively trying to figure something out. And because they're working on that, it kind of creates easy access for drama, right? Because they can always find something new out, and then it's like another bowling ball drops, and then you're going from that plot point to another one. Whereas when you're dealing with where there's no investigative character, where people aren't necessarily trying to figure out things,
mm-hmm.
but they're trying to safeguard themselves, and so how do you release information in that kind of a setting? And yeah, and I think I learned it pretty well.
That's great. I've heard that a lot, that pacing is something that a lot of people struggle with. So to feel that you've honed that and it's working for you, that's great. You also say in the acknowledgements that looking back over the past year, like many, many things, it's a miracle that this book wasn't delayed. And so were you actually still in final edits when the pandemic began? What stage were you at with this?
I don't even think I had started developmental edits. I had basically sold it, and it was all pretty much done during the pandemic. So the whole editing process, and it was really a credit. That's not so much to my credit. It's really a credit to my editor at Grand Central Publishing, that she was able to somehow keep up with everything, even though, you know, her whole office environment and her workflow and everything has changed.
Right. And how has it affected you in general, working creatively, productively? And you've got two daughters, right?
Yes.
So how have you found yourself, you know, how have you kept yourself going?
Yeah, it's it, well, I think some of the most difficult stuff is just trying to find a quiet space to chat when my kids are all home and my husband's home and there's, you know. But I think originally it was very difficult when my kids were kind of home and it wasn't the schools didn't really know what they were doing, because then I was having to basically be a homeschool teacher during the day and then right at night. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a lot of sleep. But, you know, then the school's kind of figured it out, and so now it's been a lot more smooth sailing.
Right.
And my kids actually have not been back to school to an actual building since last March.
Yes, true of so many, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, kudos to parents, you know, because I don't have kids, and I think, you know, how much this would have been exacerbated if I'd had to homeschool, too. So,
yeah.
Job well done.
Well, I don't know. We'll wait to see their math grades. But,
well, you know, as long as they're still sane, and you know, you're, I think that's part of the achievement there. I'd like to throw three words out to you and get an instant response to what they mean to you, Kate. And the first one is discipline.
Working every day.
Okay. Creativity.
Delving into your subconscious.
And spontaneity.
Oh, I'm not sure I know the meaning of that one. I'm just joking. Spontaneity, making time for joy.
There you go. Which is, it's hard to be spontaneous when you've got kids. I know that. Kids and kids and deadlines, you know. as a writer, what do you know now about writing, about publishing, about the process, whatever, that you wish you'd known when you first wrote your first book?
Yeah, well, one, I wish that I had immediately gone to conferences and tried to meet people face to face rather than kind of the blind querying with the big book of agents. I've heard, you know, rumors that works for some people, but I think it helps a lot to have that face to face interaction and actually meet people and.
Yeah.
They get a sense of who you are, and then they're more likely to take your work seriously when they're reading it.
Yeah, so, I would agree with that.
So I would definitely say that. I also think I wish I had a better sense of what my brand would be perceived as, right? So that way I could focus on the stories that I think people most want from me. Rather than sometimes occasionally writing a story where I'm like, this is so cool, and I realize it would be really cool if someone else wrote it. Nobody wants that one from me, particularly.
So, I mean, if you've done that kind of thing, have you used a pseudonym? I mean, would you go that route? Because I know several writers who do that.
Yeah, I'm considering it because I sometimes, you know, it's just, I don't get me wrong, I love writing domestic suspense, and a lot of my brain kind of works because I write from a place of anxiety, and what worries me, if they tend to be domestic suspense stories. But, you know, occasionally, like, I want to write a family drama that doesn't involve someone dying.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
right.
Or, you know, or a tech thriller that's really just, like, geeking out on some of the new technology that's out there. And the problem is that, well, I think I can do it pretty well. I just think that then you could disappoint people that are expecting a certain kind of story from you.
Yeah. Most of the big writers, I mean, if we look at them, you know, Stephen King for one, Dean Koontz, they've all written books under different names. And I had a friend who was dragged kicking and screaming when she wanted to write a different kind of story. Her agent and her editor said, you have to change your name. You have to do it under a different name. And she really, really resented it. But once the series came out and was a success, she made sure her real name was back on those books.
Yeah, well, also, I mean, there's only so many things you can answer to.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I already find that, you know, I started to write under Kate rather than Catherine because at the time I was a journalist and I felt if I ever went back to journalism, I didn't want people being like, well, doesn't she write fiction? And it impairing my ability to sell, you know, nonfiction articles.
Yes.
So
yeah.
I started to go by Kate, which was a nickname that I had, but not many people used. And now I have to answer to Kate and Catherine. So I can only imagine if I also have to answer to like Elizabeth or something else.
Well, we'll wait and see on that one. So tell us, what we're almost at the end of our conversation here, but what do you know about life now as a woman that you wish you'd known 20 years ago?
Oh, you know, and this won't be popular with everyone, I would say never quit your job. And what I mean by that is, like, it's fine if you go to a different career, but I think that unfortunately, I think that it's very hard to take time off to be with kids, as so many of us like want to do, and then even when you get back into it, to get back into it in a way where your job is respected the same as the person's never left work, right? And so what I would recommend to my daughters is, like, never fully leave, which I know is, you know, which isn't fair to them, because it's basically saying, hey, but that way it always starts, you know, there's always this understanding that it has to be equal and that everybody's career needs to be valued the same. So, yes, that would be my advice. I could go back.
I would echo that with you. It's a popular decision with me.
Yes.
I definitely think, yeah.
I think it's important to maintain, not that I want to portray every relationship as a power struggle, it's not like that, but I think it's important to kind of maintain its importance. And so when you're a woman, you get the respect of being able to exist in multiple spaces, and you don't end up being like mom and then everything else is added, you know?
Yeah, you know, keeping, we talked earlier about how your parents taught you to keep your sense of self, your self-identity, and that's really important. No matter what we do in life, it's so important to keep our sense of self, because otherwise we just become, you know, names to other people, and that sense of self has gone. And that applies to men too. I just coached a guy friend through this. He's much younger than me, but he and his wife were going through a separation, and he had lost his identity. So it happens to everybody. We're not careful. Yeah.
Well, that's good to know. I'm always glad to know when it crosses gender. Because sometimes, you know, you hear the experiences sometimes more from your own gender, and so you feel like, is this just something women are dealing with? So it's actually a relief to know.
Yeah. Well, it's been great talking with you, Kate. Her Three Lives. We're looking forward to your next book and finding out what's happening with that one. We'll have to wait on that. And I want to just give listeners your website, which is katehollihan.com. And final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Kate.
I think what we were saying about maintaining your sense of self, and just don't let anyone else define it for you.
Perfect. Thank you so much. I want to thank everyone for joining us today. Questions, comments, or feedback on today's show, you can find me through our website at conversationslive.net. Please join us next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.